Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Moving Spotlight Podcast. My name is John Ruby. I'm talking like this because we have a voiceover and actor artist coming later, and I got to keep up with his voice. That's a little preview. I'm here with my main man. What's up?
Hey, Corbin Coyle. Hey, everybody.
Hey, everyone. Still raining in LA. It's never going to end. It's torrential.
It's
here.
It's pouring today.
We have weather, folks, so stop saying it's always 70 and sunny. It is not.
It
we
is
are
68
now Seattle.
And rainy.
It is 68 and rainy. Everything is cold. None of these houses are built with insulation, so it's chilly. Corbin, topic of the day. Favorite amusement park.
Favorite amusement park.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is kind of interesting.
This is a tough one for me because I like going to amusement parks, but I get motion sick pretty bad. So like going on rides, I have like a limited like two rides I can do. And then I have to just kind of tap out for the rest of the day. But I kind of always like, I don't know if I love Disneyland, but I love how strange it is there. Like everything is curated and perfect in this kind of eerie way, but almost kind of this magical way too. So whenever I go there, I'm always like blown away by how curated everything is. I don't know if I have a favorite amusement park because whenever I walk away from there, I'm feeling a little sick. What about you? Yeah. Well,
with Disneyland, I went on that Star Wars Rise of the Resistance. Ooh, that ride is, it's amazing to see though. I mean, it is like just you feel like you're in the movie. It's so well done. I was just like this is awesome.
I definitely went through that one because I was like, this is gonna be really cool, and it was, but it was definitely a lot for me. It's just like a screen and movement and lights.
That's how I felt with the Harry Potter ride. If people have been to Universal and Harry Potter Land, you're on like a claw and the whole thing moves, and then the claw moves around like I felt that way afterwards, Corbin. I was like, whoa, like, cause you're never stop moving. But I go back to, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and at my school, if you behaved well, you got to go to Six Flags Great America outside Chicago. Oh. So that was always like the gold standard. Yeah. And they had like an old wooden roller coaster called the American Eagle that was classic, and they had like Shockwave, which is this big bright blue one with a huge drop that you could see as you were driving up in the bus. You're like, Shockwave, you know, like that thing, be careful, because of that first, you know, downward one. I think those, and then I do remember going, and now I can't remember which park it was. It might have been out here, but it's the one where it spins in a circle and you stick against the wall, I love that one. Like you're stuck against the wall. And then I heard that at one point, this is like a, you know, a story you hear, someone like threw up and it's like stuck against the wall as they're spinning, you know, which is like, the vision, you can't get that out of your mind. Once you've heard that, which I just told you, now it's in your brain forever. So for some reason that ride lost a little luster after I heard that story.
Oh, that's rough. Yeah.
But yes. Yeah. So a bunch of different places that I've enjoyed. All right. Well, that's a good topic we came up with. I like that one. That's a fun one. I want to get to our guest today. Super excited to have him here. I want to welcome to the show actor, producer, and writer Jason Kelly. Hey, Jason, how you doing?
What's cracking? How you doing, man?
What's up? Any amusement park thoughts on that? You got a place?
Yeah, I love that whole get down. I'm a huge amusement park fan. At least I was up until about 40. I grew up in Virginia, and so we had this spot called King's Dominion, which was down by Richmond, and it was very similar to a Six Flags.
Okay.
It had this old wooden roller coaster called the Rebel Yell and the Grizzly, and they were both rickety and they were loud and they were fast. And then, you know, obviously when it got corporatized, it gets this influx of all the Zoom coasters and all that. It can go from 0 to 80. You know, in 3 seconds. And I took my nephew down there one time for, he was like 10. I picked him up from, I skipped work, picked him up, took him down, and got on a blast coaster that did go from 0 to 80 in like 5 seconds.
Oh my God.
And all of a sudden I was like, oh, I might be on this thing. And I had a headache all day long, and I couldn't deal with it. I did do we had a ride that did the spun. We had the spinning thing, and I did that one time, and that was a bad idea. I was probably the guy that threw up. And because it was spinning that way, whoever was this way pretty much caught everything that came from me.
Oh,
sorry.
No. Are you serious? Are you just Andrew, or are you serious?
Yeah, oh, no, God. I was the dude. I was that guy. I had eaten a funnel cake right before.
Extra strawberries.
And then the last time I've been to an amusement park, I went to Six Flags up in Valencia.
Yep.
And I got on one of the roller coasters. I was fine. And then at the very end, it corkscrewed down. And as I was going down, I was like, oh, I'm passing out. I'm passing. And then it brought me back out. I got off the ride. I went, all right, guys, I think I'm done. They're like, what? I got off the ride, walked to my car, hopped in, and went home. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
I'm good.
That's crazy. I was going to say the same thing. I get that same thing where I pass out. Yeah. I thought that was a myth. And then as soon as it goes too far of a turn, I just go lights out. And I wake back. It's very jarring because you feel like you've been out for a while.
It's very jarring. I think once you hit 35, you might need to lay off roller coasters that spin, that do loops.
That's stuff for sure. But I remember the last kind of roller coaster I went on, what I didn't really like is when you got the thing over your shoulders. And I remember my head bouncing back and forth. That really bugged me. It's just like kind of the jarringness of it. You know, I mean, some of them are smoother, but like some of the older ones are really jarring. And I was like that. I just, my brain, my body was like, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I'm going to have fun. Yeah. And the problem with some of these coasters is, you get there, you ride it, and then all of a sudden you'll either get a headache or a kink in your neck or something. Your body is kind of jacked for the rest of the day. And so you just can't enjoy yourself. So I'm sure my kid will end up loving it and wanting to go. And I'm like, all right, I'll take it. But,
you're going on it. So I remember I saw a video of like normal people in jets as they pulled like whatever 5G's or something, and people just pass out. It's just people passing out, like you know, those guys that get used to it somehow, I guess, or breathe through it, but just people like they're trying, and then also they just pass out. You're like, good thing they're not flying that jet, you know,
like a jet.
So well, Jason, we're super excited that you're here, man. You are actually on secret location right now, which is super exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, how did you first kind of get into acting? How did you find acting?
Acting kind of found me. I had moved to LA. I was pursuing some different path, and that path didn't work out. And I didn't want to turn tail and go home. So I was at the gym one day, working out, and a gentleman approached me and asked me if I had ever thought about doing commercials and acting. And it was actually Mike Pointer. Hey, I saw your commercial.com.
Oh, yeah.
And I took his workshop and completed it. And that was the first little round of acting. I signed an agent right out of it, still with them to this day. That kind of led from, you know, commercials to classes to Second City to IO and the whole improv world to taking dramatic classes. And I just kept on wanting to improve myself and get better. And then I stood in on a feature film and got to see an entire project get made up close from the beginning to the end. And it was, you know, it was a football movie. And it was starring The Rock. And I kind of went, oh, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I want to really just get good at acting, you know, make good content. And so all of the money and all the resources that I made from commercials got poured into just developing myself and developing my craft and learning, and one step at a time. And I worked my way up from there. Did a lot of stage early on, a lot of improv. And now I'm kind of at this point where you're at this weird juncture where you go, all right, it's either some big guest stars, some big recurring guest stars, or a series. Mm-hmm. Or a great part in the film that is going to satisfy that craving to want to create at a high level. Mm-hmm. And do it consistently enough. Because right now I think you can very easily get caught up in a space where you're gigging all the time, which is fine. But building a career to me is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's like two different lanes. And I think you have to either get on a series or get in the lane of doing really good parts in film to start that journey of building a career. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah, there's something interesting with what you're saying. I mean, kind of at the end there, when I was taking away this idea of sometimes if you kind of keep plucking the low-hanging fruit, you never reach for the higher fruit. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of figure out, you know what I mean? Okay, there might be a little bigger gap here, but the payoff is more, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so I'm kind of, you know, like you're saying, you're kind of And I think that's challenging. I think that's hard for every actor to figure out is like, well, do I stop doing co-stars? You know, well, sometimes co-stars are bigger than what they used to be. Sometimes it's good to be on set. Well, I just want to do guest stars. I want to do recurring. I want to have my own, you know, I totally get that. And I think that that's challenging. It's challenging because you're working on your craft. I feel like everyone, Jason, also like feels like I'm ready for the lead role, which right. sometimes you are. And then sometimes you really are ready. You know what I mean? But sometimes you're like, oh, I'm totally ready. And then you look back, you're like, oh, 5 years ago, I thought I was ready. But like, man, I was, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's interesting how that changed until you kind of know you are. You that know, makes sense.
Yeah. So you know the temperature of how the business and how those roles work till you actually get to see it. Like, I always thought I was ready. I thought I was ready when I first got here. And then I realized, oh, no, you're not. And even when I had gotten to a point where I'd done enough stage where I went, okay, I'm ready. I look back at that time frame and I go, oh, no, I wasn't, because I was still very eager. Mm-hmm. And I think unless you're getting your hand held through that process of transitioning into a lead or a regular role, unless you get some guidance through that, you can actually hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. And over the last probably the last 5 years, 6 years, there's just been a shift in me and how I approach what we do and how I've observed other leads and series regs and understood what we're actually doing, what we're representing, and then how to carry yourself in that space. Mm-hmm. I think in the last 5 years of a 20-year career, I've just now gotten to that point where I'm going, yeah, I can handle it. And it's partly because I'm not chasing it anymore. Mm-hmm. Like I want it, but I genuinely don't care if it doesn't happen, because I have something that's so much more important to me in my life that, like, I've reached the peak of creativity as a human being. I've created a child and I'm raising that. Anything else that I do here is less than that. Mm-hmm. And so because of that kind of awareness that I just have, anything else that gets added to it, whether it's a regular or a lead or a creative show or any of that stuff, it still pales in comparison to the creation of a human being and watching a version of you grow and learn. So because of that, I'm just in this very comfortable space of, yes, I'd like it. It would change my career. It would, you know, the income would be considerably different and better, but I'm also going, it's going to take time away from my kid. Mm-hmm. So it better be something I really want to do and not just something that I book and feel obliged to take. It needs to be something that I really want to have fun and commit to. Because every moment I spend there is a moment I'm spending away from him. And I feel that far more than not being on set. Doesn't hurt as much not to be on set.
How do you balance that, sort of, to use a buzz term, like work-life balance, when it comes to like being away from your son, which you of course want to be there every second.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work with you and your world?
You know, my wife and I both work from home. You know, when I'm not working or I'm not on set, I'm at home. Mm-hmm. So I'm in my son's life really consistently. And so we spend a great deal of time together, and we spend quantity and quality together. Mm-hmm. I had to learn the hard way in that as soon as he was born, I took off to Toronto for 5 months and did Mayor of Kingstown. Mm-hmm. That was hard, real hard, because I wanted to be there for all of those first time moments. And what I learned is that I don't have to be there for everything. I was working actually with Mike Beach on that show. Mike's got nine kids. And he's got, like, he's been married before. So he had one family with his first wife. And then he's got another family with his second wife, and they're all young. And Mike's 10 years, you know, Mike's, I think, yeah, he's in his 60s now. And I was asking, like, one, how do you balance, mm-hmm. that, like, you got nine different people pulling at you, seven, whatever it is. And he was like, you know, when you're with your kids, just be with them. When you're with your family, just be with them completely. I don't pick up my phone. I don't text while they're with me. We're not on the TV a lot. Like, we'll watch a movie together, but we just spend really quality time when we're together. And my focus is on them, so that when I go, and he works constantly, when I go, they understand that daddy's got to go to work and this is what pays the bills. And he's like, his younger kids, they're accepting of it and they understand what it is. So I think a lot of it is largely how you communicate that with your family, and how you ensure that when you're home, you're present. It's interesting. It's just like being an actor and being in a great scene. The more present you are and the more relaxed you are, the better everything's going to go. Mm-hmm. And the more honest the scene's going to play. The more present you are when you're at home, the better the quality of your work-life balance will be. I do my best to put my phone down when I'm with my kid. I do my best not to watch a lot of TV. I don't watch much TV. He does. Mm-hmm. He watches Paw Patrol. Pretty yeah. tough. Yeah. Seen every episode. I haven't seen. I'm so far behind on everything I watch that I don't even know what I'm watching anymore. But that's the best way I can say it. Is just stay present, stay focused, turn your phone off, and just be with your kids and your spouse.
Yeah, I like that, Jason. This idea of staying present, because I think it's so easy to be looking forward and thinking of the to-do list or all these other things, or, you know, I got to work on that self-tape, or I got to get these lines ready, or kind of thinking back and then just trying to be kind of in that moment with, if you're in a relationship, if you're with someone, if you're with your son or daughter,
yep.
you know, friends. Yeah. I think that is really, you start to, not that you don't value your time, but you really start to value it as you get a little older and as it feels yep. like that time gets kind of more squeezed. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. I try to be very deliberate with my time, you know, and yeah. I try to plan stuff, you know, so I can work out in the morning before they're even awake. And then once yep. they're up, great, I'm back and I've got my yep. workout in, so I feel good, but then yep. I'm around them. Because it's funny you said that. I was just thinking, I the movie I produced, Solver, that I acted in, I was gone for a month the year my son was born. So it was like, you know, this movie happened, was it, you know, so I was gone for a good chunk, it felt like. And that is hard. It is hard to go away, but you have to also balance with like, well, this is the way our business works, where when there's exactly. a good opportunity,
yep.
you got to kind of follow that, right?
Yeah. You know, we do, I think in the grand scheme of thing, when you compare what we do for a living compared to a 9-to-5 that works a corporate gig where they go to the office every single day, I mean, we're home more often than we're not. I mean, if we're keeping it real. So they're home in consistent windows, mm-hmm. right? So morning, evening, we know that they're going to, you know, you're going to be home if you have a traditional job. And ours, we can be home for weeks on end and then intense moments of time where we're not there and we're not present. So I think it in and of itself, what we do balances it out, where you work really, really hard and then you live really, really hard. And I think when I put it in that context, I feel really fortunate that this is what we do for a living, because I don't know too many people who've been around their child from the time that they were born to 3 years old and they see you in the house all the time. Mm-hmm. And what he's mapping for me and my wife, he's got our personalities down, and our sense of values are almost already downloaded. So there's no version of a reality for him where he goes, oh, mommy and daddy go to work every day and leave the house. Mm-hmm. He leaves the house to go to school and he's gone and we're at the house working. So, and his idea of work is, oh, he asked me when I was leaving the other day, he's like, oh, you go to school now? I was like, no, I'm not going to school. Because that's what he relates to work.
Sure.
Right. Sure. So yeah. I think that's kind of it's a benefit and a blessing. I wouldn't have it any other way. And, you know, obviously my hope is that if and when I book something is consistent work, it's local in LA, or we have the flexibility to just relocate temporarily to where we're at and we'll all be together. So.
Jason, if someone is kind of starting out, you know, you kind of mentioned it, which I love. I was thinking when you mentioned Mike Pointer, hey, I saw your commercials. I remember Stuart K. Robinson had a commercial class that yeah. I went to early yeah. on. Yeah, yeah. yeah. And it's funny yeah. when you said that, it you know, many years ago, yeah. And that was great. But if someone's moving to LA or New York, do you feel like, and you did mention improv, which I also did and loved, and you know, kind of more dramatic scene study classes or Meisner, I'm not sure exactly. What do you think someone should like really jump into first? Like kind of like looking back, would you say you're glad you did a bunch of different things? Or would you say start here? What kind of advice would you give them?
I am glad that I did a bunch of different things because you need to figure out, you got to figure out your lanes, right? Like some people are naturally really, really funny. So they got to decide, am I going to be an improviser or stand-up comedian? Or am I a really good writer, a comedic writer? You got to figure out what you offer. And this is for people that are coming here, you know, fairly, for the most part, fresh off the street and didn't go to one of the big schools and have all of that training. And even people that went, you know, to a great state school for drama and theater, you still need to figure out what your particular niche is going to be in this business, because the business is big, it's broad, and they want you to be specific. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for them to package and to pinpoint where to put you. So I do think that it's important to try and do a lot of different things. I still contend and believe that the best actors are stage performers. Film is definitely, they're all different mediums, but acting's acting, and you need to know from a live audience what does and does not work with your energy, mm-hmm. you know? And I think all too often people come out to LA with this expectation of, oh, I'm going to be a film actor, I'm a TV actor, and I'm going, they're the same. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's just different things you're doing in each medium that if you have a couple of years, 3, 4, 5 years of consistent stage training under your belt, you're going to be better at manipulating yourself and your instrument in those camera-based mediums. Mm-hmm. So two things. One, I don't recommend anybody young come to LA or New York to get started in the TV film business, because both those cities are incredibly and possibly expensive to survive in. Mm-hmm. They just are. When we moved to LA, and you know, it was a different time. The cost of living wasn't as high as it is right now, and you could go there and get yourself a little apartment and work your way through training and development, and the time it takes to get seen and have success. You could do that. I don't know too many people that can actually financially afford to do that anymore, unless you have the wherewithal or you have a side job. I think Atlanta, Austin, New Orleans, Chicago are all great towns for you to go cut your teeth, make your mistakes there, learn, grow, develop, get all of your training out, and then pull the trigger on one of the big markets to make that jump. My nephews had a friend they went to high school with from, doesn't matter where, but they went to high school with, and he was trying to get into the film business, and he called me. And he was like, I got this money saved and blah, blah, blah. Me and my roommate, we're going to move out to LA. I said, don't come to LA. Mm. He said, what? I said, don't come to LA. It's, if you've got $30,000, 30 grand, if you're spending $2,000 a month on rent, how long are you going to be here? Mm-hmm. He said, if you're spending $400 a month on rent, how long do you have to survive? And he went, oh, I was like, yeah, go to Atlanta. Mm. It's cheaper. And there's just as much work, and he's thriving down there. Mm-hmm. He's doing well. So I'm not trying to dash anybody's hopes, but you know, I do well for myself, and I've done well for myself the entire time. I came out intentionally. Once I started, I intentionally said, I'm not going to be a broke actor. I'm going to work. I'm going to figure out a way to make money doing this thing. And I'm going to work through, I'm going to take that, and I'm going to struggle in my creativity and struggle in learning how to be a creative voice and having a voice. I'm going to struggle in that, but I'm not going to be broke. Mm-hmm. Nope. I don't do broke. I don't. So that was, that's kind of my take on it. I know it might be a unique position, and maybe even a little slightly arrogant, and maybe even a little unrealistic to those listening, but 20 years, I probably had 4 or 5 years where I, you know, it was lean, very, very lean, but it was never a situation where I was, where I had to have a day job. Mm. I always made enough, but I also lived really, really lean. I lived low. Mm. I didn't spend a lot. And I took my time developing as best I could, but I almost always, when I look back, I found myself putting the cart before the horse. And I think the one thing that I would probably have done differently, I had an opportunity right around 2008, 2009 to go start doing regional theater. Mm-hmm. And if I look back on how I developed, I would have pursued that. And I would have left LA and gone and done regional theater for about 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And get developed. Because I keep looking at all the cats that are in my lane, in my age and type range, mm-hmm. and the ones that are all working constantly and getting all the jobs and getting all the movies and projects where, you know, they're turning out spectacular work and getting nominated for industry awards. And we don't do that. We don't do what we do for that. I'm just using it as an example. Mm-hmm. All of them did extensive regional theater for an extended period of time. And I did theater in LA. And there's nothing wrong with theater in LA. It's just your attention and your focus is always bifurcated between, oh, I got to go do this job or go do this booking, versus no, I'm on stage every night for, you know, 6 to 8 shows for 2 months. That's all I'm doing. That's what I'm focused on doing. And I think there's something intangible that comes from being under that type of development for an extended period of time. And I'm not saying that I don't have that, those kind of chops. I do. I've developed them over time. I think doing that condenses the amount of time mm-hmm. for you to develop and get better and get masterful at your craft. Because that's ultimately what we're talking about, is getting to the point where you're mastering nuances. Mm-hmm. And those nuances begin to show up on camera and on film, because TV film is all about relaxation. And I think the more you know how to play your instrument, the more you just relax into your role and your character.
It feels very intentional, just like you were saying, when it came to raising your son or like doing your job. It's like all this is very intentional, and you keep yourself there in the moment. And so when you're like doing this regional theater, you can kind of really hone your craft and really only focus on that. And it's very difficult to find, but it's possible. You just kind of have to go for those kind of opportunities. But
yeah, I mean, and you have to be willing to be a nomad for a period of time. You have to be willing to unplug and go, okay, I'm going to be living pretty much out of a suitcase. Yeah. You can have a home base. Like almost all these people that I'm talking about did have a home base, because you hear it in their interviews. Mm-hmm. Coleman Domingo, phenomenal. Dude's just an elegant actor. Mm-hmm. New York was his home base. Started doing a lot of regional theater, was in North Carolina for a long stretch. You could hear that he always went back and touched base with New York, but he was where the work was at. Mm. Bryan Cranston, you listen to his book, read his book, listen to his audiobook, same deal. He was doing a lot of regional theater down, I think he was in Tampa or Orlando, one of the two, but he was down there for a good stretch developing his craft before he went to New York. And you know, ultimately booked a soap opera. And these are the people whose work that I love. You know, those are, you know, him, them. God, there's so many. Sterling K. Brown, like these, the people, they're phenomenal at what they do. And when I look at their journey, there's a pattern. Mm-hmm.
There's a pattern. Well, I'm thinking about, Jason, there's a place actually in the Netherlands called Boom Chicago, which is an improv place. And it's where Seth Meyers came from, Jason Sudeikis, you know, Ike Barinholtz, like a bunch of people. But you're going so far away from like Hollywood or New York, but they got so good at their craft. And it's funny too, because you're thinking of like an international audience, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe like English, maybe isn't even their first language, mm-hmm. and then have come back and had so much success. But like, that's really an interesting, I really like that kind of take. I think there's a lot of merit to it. Sometimes I feel like, Jason, when we're realistic, it can sound pessimistic, but it's like, I'm just being realistic, but it can sound in this business pessimistic.
Yeah.
And I think it's more challenging than ever to be a working actor. It's really hard. Yes. And so with what you're saying, you know, rising costs and then kind of a little bit of the hollowing out of, you know, SAG commercials, which is how a lot of working actors I know kind of helped pay for those drier spells. Yep. With that kind of a shifting landscape, I think you're right. That's a really interesting I like that take. I mean, I think there's a lot to it. I also think, Jason, there's another thought I had. The people that are so stubborn are like, I don't care. Like, you need that resilience. You know what I mean? Like, I don't give a crap. I'm still going. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're going to need that resilience because that's what's going to, you know, my dad used to always, because I told him I was going to be here 2 years and then be a megastar. And so like 5 years in, my dad's like, how are those 2 years going? I'm like, they're going great. I'm at year 10 now, Dad. I'm at year 15, you know? So you just gotta, you know, do what's right for you, whatever.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you definitely have to do what's right for you. And, you know, I think anybody out there who's an artist and creative and has a voice and is willing to wear different hats, multiple hats at the same time, I think you can come here and you can definitely carve out the career that you want. I came out, you know, when I started, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be a star and all that stuff. And I wanted to have that success as a result of the work. It was never, I want to be a star just because, right? If that was the case, I'd have done reality TV years ago because I got opportunities to do that. But I said, no, I actually want to be good at a craft. I want to be good at this thing because it's hard. And it's harder than I thought it was going to be. And it's challenging and it fulfills me a certain way. And then also, you know, you got to know yourself. You got to know why you're doing something. Mm-hmm. You either got to know why you're doing something, or you got to know what's underneath, what's driving you. And it took me a while to figure all this out, largely through some acting classes, but I have a massive void for within me that's rooted in it, getting attention. And it's something that I came to grips with, came to terms with, and came to understand. But while I was developing, I didn't realize where it was coming from. So I did a lot of personal work and digging in there to try and get a better understanding of it. And once I understood the seat of that kind of gnawing, it allowed me to stop trying for that apex of success. And it kept me from defining my success based on becoming known as an actor. I was able to move it. I was able to move my intention and detach it from that need for attention and attach it to the need for mastering something that I was going to work on for the rest of my life. And so now that I'm in this space of mastering my craft and learning these tools and going out and going, no, I actually know how to go out and build that. I want to now start doing it at the highest level I can and as much as I can all the time. And I understand that in doing that, I'm satisfying something in me that tells that little 7-year-old that's kind of not broken, but just has a hole in him. You go sit down. I'll take care of you. I'm going to go over here and work on this work. And I'm going to share it with you first. This is all kind of metaphysically speaking, but I'm going to share my craft with you first and see how you're entertained by it. And then I'm going to go off as the adult and go out here and present it to the writers and the directors and the producers, and eventually it'll get into the hands of the world. And if it's good, they'll decide. If it's not, you and me are good because we came from this shy person that couldn't do that to this person that can do it now. So that's our win. That's our satisfaction. And that's what seals and heals that need for attention and outer recognition. I'm giving you the recognition that you need. I'm giving you room to go play. I'm giving you room to go explore and be youthful in a performance. And if you get, you know, applause, great. If you don't, great. I'm applauding you. Not patting you on the back for saying, oh, good job. I'm saying, no, you did a thing. You took words on a page and you brought it to life best you could. And there has to be some sense of personal satisfaction in that, that's free of judgment, so that you can do a job, leave it where it's at, leave it on the table and walk away and be whole because you don't control how the audience is going to respond. You hope they respond favorably, but sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And I've been on receiving ends of it. And if you're seeking their approval, you're going to always be seeking their approval. And if you can't handle the criticism, you're in a really effed situation. Mm-hmm. And I kind of gotten to a point where I've detached myself from both results and am free to just play around. And if they like it, great. If they don't, okay. I take full responsibility for whatever comes out there and is out there of me, or whatever I create from that point forward. I take full responsibility for it. And my taking ownership of it somehow satisfies not needing to get recognition and approval from the outside world. I hope that all makes sense. It's a lot.
No, it does. I think you, on one level, you have to somehow fall in love with the work. That's what you're saying. You fell in love with the work. But then on the other level, I think what you're talking about there, Jason, is this letting go of the outcome. Mm-hmm. You know, and letting go of like the need, like I have this big, strong need, you know, for you to say I'm funny or I'm talented. And that's really, really hard, especially for a lot of people that get into this. I hear what you're saying, you know, and I think those two things are things that are, you know, part of the mental game, the spiritual game, the emotional game that can be really challenging. Mm-hmm. It's funny, Jason, because I think it's really interesting, this idea of like maybe a lot of this, like, I just heard this, life is not all about adding stuff on, but it's kind of about unfolding, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting idea, right?
Taking layers off.
Right. But we always think of like, well, if I learn this trick and mm-hmm. if I do this and this, and it's like, well, maybe a lot of this stuff is already kind of in you.
Yeah.
You need to figure out how to kind of open it up, unfold it, let it blossom. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
Saying, you know, it's a really, it's challenging, but that's part of the, you know, the process of the journey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first started, I was very much that guy. Let me try this trick. Let me try this. And I was putting all this stuff on, going out in the industry, in the world, and working from that place. Sometimes it worked, but most of the times it didn't. And when I failed the most, and I've failed a lot, I'm like, I've mastered the art of the faceplant. and yet, even through those face plants, I've still managed to find my success. But I think right around 40 is when everything shifted for me. Because I started acting at 31. So I had a previous career, corporate sales, did that for 8 or 9 years and then switched gears and started all the way over. And I didn't know what I was doing. So I had years of unlearning that had to be done, you know? I do think in terms of, you know, people that are pursuing the craft, the younger you can start and the earlier you can commit to it and commit to the craft of mastering yourself, the better. Because once you've got all these layers of life built up that you got to take apart, you're going to have some undoing to do. And that undoing can be daunting and be disorienting and also it could put you in a space where you don't want to do the work, where you don't want to do the very thing that we do for a living, because it requires you to get very honest and direct with yourself and to look inside. Because at the end of the day, no matter what anybody says, I don't care how good the actor is. I don't care what name you throw out as the greats. If they're playing a character, sorry, no, that's really a version of you that you're playing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe wearing a different hairstyle that you normally use, different makeup, different clothing. That's still you. And I get there's who you are and then who a character can be, but it's still you. Mm-hmm. We're playing pretend at an extremely high level and some playing for keeps, right? Mm-hmm. We hear stories about people that go method so deep that they get in trouble and can't come out, or they get sick, or they have to get on medication, if they don't have a way of retreating and finding their core self again. We hear stories about this. It's because you're playing around with your psyche, right? And when you're playing around with your own mentality, you can get yourself into places where that mental state of being sticks to your normal neutral, your neutral self. And I think part of the art of mastering the craft is learning how to get back to yourself, letting go so much of who you think you are and going all the way left and becoming the Joker, for lack of an example, going all the way over there and then being so clear on what you're doing that you can let that go and then get back to being Heath. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think that's what the real craft, in my opinion, is being that elastic that you can do it and create space for yourself to hold being that person while the cameras are rolling and through that period of time that you're filming. And in order to do that, I think most performers have to find a place where they get really, really healthy on them. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know some of these people that I'm mentioning, but Robert Downey Jr.'s been great. He was great when he was a kid. He was a teenager. He was great. But he was also broken. Mm-hmm. He's talked about this. He was also very broken. And part of that brokenness is what allowed him to be that good then. But it wasn't until he got healthy that his career actually took off and he started doing the best work he's ever done. Mm-hmm. Right? And now he's like, God, I'm just playing now. Mm-hmm. Like, I can be Tony and I can go over here and be, what you call it, an Oppenheimer. I can do all of this and then I can come back to my center and I don't have to do the things that I did before to get back to center. Mm-hmm. Ah, man, that's the journey to me. That's the work, mm-hmm. in my opinion. I know, like I said, I know it's a lot. Most of the, whenever I get asked these questions, I'm going, do y'all really want to hear all this?
Y'all ready?
Just trying to get you inside of my process and what goes on in my head. And again, mind you, I'm still doing commercials heavily. I'm still doing, you know, recurring guest stars pretty heavily. I still do stage. But this approach to the work, I wasn't doing this when I first started. I was putting other tricks on. Mm-hmm. And as I started getting healthy and started dealing with me, and taking off those layers and peeling that onion and getting down to the core of what really makes me work and tick as a human being, it's made the work easier to step into. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still hard as hell, but it's just made stepping into a role easier.
Mm-hmm. I think any art form, like the more you just open up and are honest and you're showing a very raw person or raw version of yourself, the better. Yep. And but it comes, yeah, like you said, it can't come at a cost. You just have to be healthy and kind of know where that line is.
Yeah.
When it comes to, like, you know, mastering the craft and everything, I guess to pivot just a little bit, when it comes to like your VO work and everything that you've done when it comes to like video games and everything, how did that change for you? How did that kind of was your improv kind of a big like tool in your tool belt when it came to like working in those booths, or how was that work?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think of all of my training and my development and my skill set, voiceover and specifically in gaming and in animation, I found a sweet spot where I never felt as free to create as I do inside the booth or in the volume when I'm doing mocap. It's just a connection of all the little synapses and all the tools and the tricks and abilities that naturally are in me that have been refined and honed. It all kind of came together in voiceover. And I play probably the most in those spaces. And I'm grateful, but I'm also not surprised that the success came in that way, mm-hmm. because that was the one area that people were saying something to me about my, they were always saying, you got a great voice, you got a great voice, but I just didn't know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. And that was something, you know, I was being pitched voiceover, you know, in 2005 and 6 before I even was remotely calling myself an actor. Once I got into gaming, and mind you, I very rarely have booked commercially in voiceover. But once I got into gaming, it exploded. And all of a sudden I'm in this space where I can improvise, but at the same time I can give a really grounded, honest, vulnerable performance. Yes, you have all the time in the world to try all these different takes. And most of the time they're Frankensteining together our performance from all the takes we give. But the depth that I can go on those type of roles, I don't know. I've just found a deeper part of myself that's more resonant, I guess I should say, in some of the roles that I've been offered to play and some of the roles that I've auditioned to play. It just kind of clicked. I mean, Deathloop, I just knew where his sense of humor was. Mm. That's the reason I got that job. Mm. I was very clear on what Colt's sense of humor was and how to play him. Mm. And it worked. I was right. And it worked not just for me, but for the developer, for narrative director, for the writers, and for ultimately the gamers. And again, it's one of those things where you do a job and then you got to put it in somebody's hands and let them decide. Mm-hmm. And of all the other jobs that I've done in the voiceover world and the ones that I've continued to do, I've got 5 or 6 under NDA right now that are completed in the can. All these characters are different. There's so little ego in that space that it's just about the creativity. And it's just about finishing the job and doing the job. Whereas you get on a set for the TV or film and you just bump into a lot of ego. And I'm not wired to deal with that very well.
Interesting.
At all. So unless I'm stepping into that space where who I am and what I've done is honored and respected as much as the next person, I don't do as well in that space at all. And it shuts me down a little bit. Whereas in the voiceover world, there's just no ego. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I thought, playing, I'm a big nerd. So I played Deathloop. I loved it. I was a big fan of everything that you've done. And honestly, I do mean this. You've unlocked like a goal of mine. Like I do want to be part of like the gaming world and kind of, it was really cool to hear you. I get this bad earworm when it comes to people saying lines, and your mm-hmm. voice line is in my head every once in a while. And so I love that that's part of it. And that's why I find it so creative and fulfilling to kind of hear everything you're saying and like kind of reaching out and kind of reaching towards our listeners to let them know how to get to the point where they're comfortable and being able to improv and be play and this all the thing that we always want to do.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to find, but it seems like you've tapped into this relaxation that's really hard to
accomplish. Yeah, it's something that started showing up right around 40, and then once I had my kid, I got married, you know, everything that happened, all my life events happened in my 40s. It was my best decade thus far. And then as I rounded the corner and turned 50, I went, what do I care about anymore? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to prove nothing. I don't have to go out on a limb to try and gain attention or justify my existence on a set or in the role. I don't have to do any of that stuff anymore. I just don't. I'm halfway through my life. And, you know, it's just, there's certain things that happen in your life that wake you up and make you realize, I need this. I don't have to try anymore. I am good enough to just be, period. If you don't like it, great. If you do, let's chop it up and let's get to work. But that whole energy of, oh, see me in, oh, I'm going to go and try. Mm-hmm. Nah, miss me with all that. I'm going to come in and do the job the way, this is what I'm going to do with it. And I'm flexible within that. And I'm going to show you in an audition or a callback that I'm directable mm-hmm. and coachable. But I'm also going to come in with a really strong point of view mm-hmm. and let you know, this is it. This is me. If you want something different, you're going to have to hire somebody else. But if you want this energy and you want to marionette it, then sure, I can do that. And we can work together. And I think it's so easy to spend so much time caught up in this cycle of, well, I'm trying to find out what they want and show them that versus, no, I've thought about it. This is what I'm going to do. And either you like it or you don't. And if you don't, bye. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. There has to be that sense of comfort in yourself has to show up so that when you get on set with anybody, you're good. And I've been in productions. I've been in scenes with Tony Award winners, and I've been in scenes with Academy Award winners and Emmy Award. I've been in these kind of spaces with them. And when I was in those scenes with them earlier on, I didn't know what I was doing. I was intimidated. Now when it happens, I'm going, I don't care what the rules are here. Because when that camera's running, them rules ain't exist. Them rules don't run. Mm-hmm. It's you and me, two human beings in a moment having a real experience. Great. You've got your little golden statue. Fantastic. At the end of the day, if I don't play this moment real with you, somebody at home is going to be watching and going, mm. So that means I have to step on your line or step. If that means I have to interject in between your lines, even though it doesn't say I do that, there. There's a period after that first sentence. You can take a breath. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask me a direct question, I'm going to give you a direct response in a heightened situation. And I'm just using this as an example, but if I'm in a heightened situation and I'm rushing into a moment and somebody steps out and asks me what's going on, I don't know is my response if I don't know.
Yeah.
If you have a sense that what's going on, if I think it was over there, if that's your little block of words, great. But if I'm rushing in and you ask me, what was that? I don't know. Well, hold on. I had my line in. I know you had your line in. But you just asked me a direct question 5 inches from me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to respond to you. It's sentence, period, sentence. Take a breath. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I like, Jason, one of the things I try to tell my students is, what if you know the character better than the writer and the director? You know what I mean? What if you know, allow yourself to know this world, to know this person, to, you know what I mean? It's an interesting thing to think about because sometimes we give away our power. We say, well, they're going to know better. They're going to know. They're going to tell me. And it's like, but what if you know? What if you know all about it? What if you know all about
it? I mean, you write. You've written films. I've written. I'm writing. I'm pitching right now. I know what I wrote. I know how long I've been living with something. But if there's a person that comes in and they got this character better than what I wrote it and understand and are bringing everything to it, stuff that I didn't even think about, why would I let my ego get in the way and say, oh, no, you got to do it the way I wrote it? Mm-hmm. I have to, at some point, just like we in the creative process, just like we have to put what we've created in the hands of an audience and let them decide whether something's good or not. The people that wrote it, the people that are directing it, the people that are producing it, you hired us for a reason. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I'm going to be taking more responsibility for what happens on screen than you are. Yeah. So I can't go up there and put bullshit that's untrue on screen because audience is going to pick up on it and they're not going to know what it was. They're going to go, there's just something about that guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just something, I don't know, it didn't seem. And it's because somewhere in our instrument, whatever was written doesn't jibe with how we communicate. Mm-hmm. It's our responsibility to make that adjustment. Yes, there's a protocol to go about getting approval for that. But still, if you're wise, a smart actor, like, there ain't nobody shooting on 35 millimeter except for a couple of people. Mm-hmm. It's all digital, man. Just give them a take. Give them what you would do and then be done.
Yeah.
They can always Frankenstein the performance with the words that they wrote later. Yeah. But I think we got to get out of this space of this preciousness of, well, the writer wrote it exactly like this verbatim, but it's not jiving with your instrument. You can't hit that note. If you can't hit that note, even if you're a classically trained performer, if you can't hit that note, you better hit the note you can hit. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they get in the booth in the editing bay and they go, yep, that's the one. It's just more authentic. Mm-hmm. And that's what everybody wants at the end of the day is the authenticity, mm-hmm. you know?
That's true.
And I'm not dismissing the people that are top tier writers that are really, really specific about what they write and the words on the page. I'm not dismissing that, but I think it's important as performers to take as much responsibility for what happens on that screen mm-hmm. as the writer and the director. Mm-hmm. And if you can collaborate and come to an agreement, great. If you can collaborate and come to an acceptance of, hey, I'm going to give you exactly what you want verbatim on the page, but then can I have the flexibility to do one my way with what comes out of my, what comes out of my instrument? Why wouldn't you, why would you say no to that? Mm-hmm. You know? So I think you have to advocate.
Yeah. I love that. Jason, you've had the opportunity to travel. You're traveling right now for work, Kingstown, mm-hmm. Aero, any of those jobs that kind of stand out to you, commercials, any job that kind of stands out to you is kind of special, you know, when you get to travel, because that's kind of rare for actors, but it's lovely when it happens.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I've done Toronto, Mayor of Kingstown. I did Aero in Vancouver, a short-lived series called The Good Guys in Dallas. This is my first time traveling for a commercial, okay. Which I was rather shocked and surprised at. Toronto, you know, part of it was because I was there for 5 months, but it was at a point in time where I knew that my time, my free time was going to dwindle. And what I mean by that is I had just had a new kid and there was only going to be one chance for me to be out in a major city, walking around, just being myself and enjoying the freedom of just not having the responsibilities. Now, I knew that that was going to, I was not going to get that many opportunities to do that again, if ever. And I don't want to either, because I want my kids, I want my wife and kid with me next time I do something big or something that's going to be that long. But that for me was one of the best, it was one of the best jobs that I had. It was a great crew, great cast. Taylor Sheridan is an amazing writer. But Toronto's a gorgeous city during the summertime. Mm. And I could live there. It was great.
Nice. Hey, Jason, we got one last part we want to get to, which is your best bad acting. All right. What we do, we're going to send you a quote in the chat, Jason, from a movie. You get to act it out however you want. Give it a fun accent. A voice, and you could take it on your cue whenever you want to.
Those of you who volunteer to be injected with praying mantis DNA, I've got some good news for you and some bad news is we're postponing those tests indefinitely. Good news is we've got a much better test for you. Fighting an army of mantis men. Pick up a rifle and follow the yellow line. You'll know when the test starts. And scene.
Oh my God. All right, Corbin, I need to help you edit these down, but that's excellent, Jason. You nailed it. Okay. Corbin, do you have a redirect for him? Any thoughts?
Redirect. I kind of want to see it like you're talking to your son, like you're telling him a little bit of a, like a, like a little bit bedtime story.
Okay. Those of you who volunteered to be injected with praying mantis DNA, I've got some good news and some bad news. But bad news is we're postponing those tests indefinitely. Good news is we've got a much better test for you. Fighting an army of mantis men. Pick up a rifle. Follow the yellow line. You'll know when the test starts.
Oh, so fun. I love it.
Good. Okay, Jason, I'm going to put you on the spot. I want like leading man, The Last of Us. This is your Braveheart, you know?
Those of you who volunteered to be injected with praying mantis DNA.
Yeah.
We've got some good news and some bad news. Bad news is we're postponing those tests indefinitely. Good news is we've got a much better test for you. Fighting an army of mantis men, pick up a rifle, follow the yellow line. You'll know when the test starts.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Oh, I like that. So good, I like Jason. That. Corbin got real quiet because he was like, I'm getting inspired.
I know, right, I was getting inspired right now. I love it.
Goosebumps. He was just thinking, this is Deathloop. This is Deathloop.
What is this from?
This is from Portal 2. It's another video game. It's J.K. Simmons. He's reading in. He's got that like army man voice. It's really good.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Jason, this was lovely, man. Honestly, I appreciate it. Sometimes, you know, we don't know where the podcast is going to go. I like that you took it deep. Yeah. I 100% love it, man. You were very honest and open, and I really appreciated your thoughts. I could tell you're a thoughtful actor. You know, you've thought about it. You've lived it. You've lived the life. I've seen you as a, you know, a working actor and star in a sense for a long time, man. You've been doing it, which is really, I give you a lot of kudos for that. You know,
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
We've come a long way. We came up in the game.
Exactly. We came up in the game. Exactly. It's exactly right. And so you got to respect that. You got to appreciate that. So we appreciate you being here, man, and taking the time to spend with us. Really.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, great having you. Enjoy the rest of your day, man. Enjoy Austin. All right.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the
Moon and Fox Life Podcast.